sanction review in the case of nondisclosure. On these issues, the state asks this court to hold as follows. First, as to the pretrial or at-trial standard to be applied by a trial court, this court should reaffirm the majority opinion of Justice Carroll in State versus Outlaw. It should hold that disclosure of an informer's identity is required only if the informer can, in fact, give testimony that would support the theory of defense to such a degree that it, quote, quoting from Justice Carroll's opinion, that it could create a reasonable doubt of the defendant's guilt in the jurors' minds. Second, with respect to post-conviction review, this court should hold that in the case of nondisclosure, a new trial is warranted only if there is a reasonable probability that had the informer's identities been disclosed to the defense, the result of trial would have been different. Similarly, if an error occurred with respect to the in-camera process in some fashion, as it did in this case, it is subject to traditional harmless error review. Finally, applying these standards to this case, the state would ask this court to conclude that although the trial court erred during the in-camera process by considering an unsworn detective's memo, such error nonetheless was harmless error. Before elaborating on these propositions, I'd like to just quickly go through the key facts. Defendant Van Manenbalk stands convicted by a jury of 8 counts of delivering cocaine to undercover officers in Sheboygan. 5 of the counts involve the presence of an informer at the transactions, and those are the ones that are at issue on this appeal. 2 counts involved sales to an undercover officer, Agent McGrath, during which 1 informer was present at both of those sales. The other 6 counts involved sales to an agent, Sturtevant, and a different informer was present at the first 3 of those sales. So we've got 5 sales at which informers were present. The last 3 drug sales that involved Agent Sturtevant, there was no informer present, and in fact, the agent himself had arranged the drug buy. Before trial, Van Manenbalk sought to disclose the informer's identities on the theory that they might have testimony to support a theory of misidentification, that the undercover officers had misidentified him. Van Manenbalk also was sought to learn by the pretrial request if either informer could shed light on why one of the undercover officers, Agent McGrath, had previously identified a photo of a third party as the cocaine seller. The trial court did an in-camera review, and it entertained affidavits from the 2 informers. Now, the affidavits appear in the record unsealed, so we know what they consist of. The affidavits are in the form of question and answers that a detective posed separately to each of the informers, during which a show-up of the defendant's photo was shown to each informer. Now, the affidavits do not expressly identify the photo used in the show-ups as that of Van Manenbalk. But I think this may reasonably be inferred from the fact that the trial court specifically had directed the detective to conduct such show-ups using Van Manenbalk's photo. This also was verified when the trial court decided that on the issue of why the agent had come up with a different identification of a third party, it was necessary to get further information because the affidavits didn't address that issue. So what happened was the detective who did the show-ups, supplied a memo to the court. The memo was not a sworn memo. It verified that in fact, the Dan Manavong photo was the photo that was used. And it explained that there had been computer information obtained by the police that linked the name Shorty, which was the only name that the informers had used in referring to the cocaine seller, linked that name to a photo of a third party named Pau Mua. And based on that link, Agent McGrath initially looked at that photo and said, yeah, that's the guy. This was after the first drug buy, and I think on the morning of the second drug buy that he was going to do. So it was actually in the process of the eighth, it was actually at the time of the, just before the third drug buy. At that point, he had doubts and information. It was eventually discovered that the third party had been, couldn't have been the seller because he was in jail out of state.
Mr. Freeman, can I interrupt you at this point?
Sure.
There seems to be some confusion, at least there was for me, as to whether or not there were two memos given to Judge Stengel or just one. There's some reference to the fact that, well, there really was just one memo and the other was a forgery or something. I don't really understand that. Could you clarify that for me?
Yes, that's memos. What you just explained was my understanding of the record. The Court of Appeals suggests that there were two memos supplied for the in-camera review, and both of them had in the subject line, or the person who was drafting the memo had this detective's name in it. The first one was the was an actual memo that the detective submitted. The second one, it turned out to, and the parties agreed by stipulation at trial, that that was a forgery that was uncovered in a computer lab training session, and they stipulated that that was, I believe that it, they went so far as to say that it was Van Manavong who had in fact drafted that, but I'm not entirely sure on that, but in any case, that memo was not a memo that was presented in camera. It was a forgery document.
Right now, my understanding is that the state is conceding that Judge Stengel should not have considered an unsworn memo, that there should have been an affidavit provided. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Is the state also conceding that Judge Stengel should not have done this next part?
I would think that that would, well, let me say that I don't think necessarily the state's input probably should have been sought at least, perhaps both parties. The in-camera is the state's opportunity. Let me backtrack one second. The threshold, there's no dispute that the threshold for the in-camera was met. The defense made a motion. There was sufficient reason to do the in-camera. Then the burden goes to the state, and the state is responsible for supplying the trial court with information that may bear on whether or not the informer can, in fact, give helpful testimony to the defense. So in the situation where the trial court is unsatisfied with the information initially provided this year, probably would have been a better, safer idea to have both parties there, but I don't know that it was absolutely necessary since it was, in fact, the state's responsibility to respond by providing information. Perhaps had that been done, the unsworn nature of this could have been avoided, and there could have been an affidavit provided with that memo. I don't think it was. I don't think it was totally inappropriate. I think it would have been a better idea, but I don't think that it was harmful in this situation, other than that it led to the problem.
What was it here?
Excuse me?
Regardless of whether it was harmful, was it here?
To do it ex parte. Yeah, I hadn't really, to be honest, I hadn't really thought about it, and my response to Justice Crooks, I think at the moment is the best I can give you, and that is that I think you know, knowing in hindsight what all happened, it might have been a good idea to have everybody's input at that point. Certainly, the court had the defense input in the in-camera request and why the defense was interested in this. And it also had, the prosecutor had suggested that the court duo show up right there, have the informant right before the court. So the fact that when it decided it needed more information, it went to a state officer to do that, I don't think necessarily was wrong in terms of what the statute was requiring or envisioning.
Brings up that kind of hope. But in this case, because it was in camera, being judges are looking at something on that basis that may or may not go to the defense.
Right, exactly. This is supposed to be an in-camera where the state is providing the information under seal to the court. The defense isn't supposed to know what's involved in this. In this case, it's a little peculiar because the way it was presented on appeal, these affidavits and all became known.
So this was ex parte.
Neither counsel was involved in that determination, correct?
No, that's different than the usual camera, where somebody knows what the judge is doing.
Right. I mean, I think the prosecutors should have been alerted before just going directly to the detective, probably.
But you're not willing to say it is error or it is not error on the civil case. Is that right?
I'm sorry?
You're not willing to say it
is error. That ex parte was, right, that it was not error, necessarily. But if it was, I would say that it's okay, yeah. The better idea would have been to have the prosecutor involved, at least, but having the defense there, I don't think necessarily follows from what the procedure envisions.
Well, in fact, doesn't the procedure prohibit the defendant from being there?
Yeah, neither counsel is supposed to be present at the in-camera, right? So, yeah, the concern that we had here in the error that obviously concerned the Court of Appeals was the unsworn nature of the memo. And our concern here is twofold, and the initial one was the Court of Appeals opinion, which has now been published on this, used language that the state believes is contrary to and counter to what the prevailing language is in the outlaw decision, majority opinion. That was one of the key concerns the state has here. At the same time, however, the fact that this was an unsworn memo, the state believes, was purely harmless error. This memo was, in fact, given to the defendant before trial. He knew exactly what was in that memo. Turning then to the first issue, the issue on the proper standard governing pretrial disclosure of an informer's identity. The Court of Appeals at paragraph 14, which is the paragraph that the state takes most umbrage with, says the trial court must not decide, quote, what is in fact helpful to a defendant. The state's position is that this is directly contrary to what the law is and what the law should be. The state therefore asks this court to vacate that language. It's directly contrary to the statutory language that says an informer's identity need be disclosed only when the informer can give testimony necessary to a fair determination of the issue of guilt or innocence. In the majority opinion in outlaw, this court said disclosure is necessary to a fair determination of guilt or innocence only if an informer's testimony would support the theory of defense to such a degree that it could create a reasonable doubt of the defendant's guilt in the jurors' minds. The outlaw majority said they specifically reject the lead opinion's articulation of the test for disclosure as being merely whether the informer's testimony was relevant and admissible to a material issue. Reaffirming this language of the majority opinion in Outlaw makes perfect sense in light of this court's recent decision in State versus Green, which State provided in a supplemental authority. In Green, this court construed identical language on the issue of disclosure of a complainant's confidential counseling records. The court unanimously said at paragraph 34 of Green, quote, "We conclude that the information will be necessary to a determination of guilt or innocence if it tends to create a reasonable doubt that might not otherwise exist." The Court of Appeals in this case apparently has not expressly suggested that this court's opinion in our law should be re-examined or that it's incorrect. And in fact, until the defendant's brief in this case, the defendant likewise did not challenge the outlaw standard. The informer's privilege statute is substantively the same as it was 20 years ago when outlaw was decided. And as I understand it, there is no claim by Van Manewong that the statute is unconstitutional or that the outlaw standards applied in interpreting the statute are unconstitutional. Even if outlaw were re-examined, it should be reaffirmed as a proper interpretation of the informer's privilege because it captures the balancing of the competing policy interests at stake. Very briefly, those interests are: the informer's privilege is intended to encourage citizen participation in law enforcement, thereby furthering the public interest in effective law enforcement. As this court observed 40 years ago, the government has an interest in the non-disclosure of informers' identities to facilitate the continued use of trusted informers. That's the Stilo case in 1963. This policy concern is of particular importance in drug cases, crimes that are difficult to detect and prove without informers, and whose repercussions often extend to the commission of other serious crimes and to the creation of other serious societal problems. Finally, of course, the informer's privilege is intended to protect the informer himself or herself from potential physical harm and retaliation. On the other side of the balance is a criminal defendant's constitutional right to present a defense. However, the United States Supreme Court has never suggested that a defendant enjoys any constitutional right to disclosure of an informer's identity. Rather, disclosure in proper cases is simply a court-imposed limitation upon the statutory privilege. In federal court, the informer's privilege is developed by the common law. There's no federal statute that has the same privilege. The seminal U.S. Supreme Court is Robiero, that's discussed in the briefs. Robiero says, disclosure is warranted only where the informer's identity or communication would be, quote, relevant and helpful to the defense of an accused, or is essential to a fair determination of the cause. Robiero says there should be no fixed rule on when disclosure is necessary, but rather that it should be assessed case by case, taking into consideration the crime charged, the possible defenses, the possible significance of the informer's testimony, and other relevant factors. Some federal courts have extrapolated a three-part test from Robiero, evaluating the level of the informer's participation or presence at the crime, the helpfulness of disclosure to an asserted defense, and the government interest in non-disclosure. In these analyses, whether it's the common law analysis of the U.S. Supreme Court or the statutory privilege that's being analyzed, the focus is on what a trial court must do or not do in deciding whether disclosure is necessary. The state asks this court to recognize the need for a case-by-case analysis, considering all relevant circumstances, and in the end, the ultimate test for disclosure should be the test that the majority opinion sets forth in outlaw. Turning then to the post-conviction standard of review and the application of post-conviction review to the facts of this case. For post-conviction review, the same reason...
Can I stop you at this point and ask you something that's troubling somewhat to me, at least? The lead opinion in Outlaw, which is what you're objecting to in paragraph 14 of the Court of Appeals decision, talks about whether or not the informer could give relevant and admissible testimony. And when I look at Roverio, Roverio also talks about relevant and helpful to the defense of the accused. What's the distinction? Why is the lead opinion in Outlaw wrong in your opinion?
Okay. I think the lead opinion addresses what would be, I would call, the threshold for the defendant to get an in-camera. If the defendant can articulate reasons why an informer could possibly give testimony that would be beneficial to the defendant, and is relevant, and it would be admissible, that would be the threshold standard. But the ultimate determination on disclosure has to be whether or not the informer can, in fact, give testimony that would support the defense, be helpful to defense, to such a degree that it would be, could potentially create a reasonable doubt in a jury's mind. In other words, it's not that the in-camera court is not going to be balancing the state's case against what the defense case might be with the informer's testimony, because the trial hasn't happened yet. But what the trial court is charged with doing is to look at what the informer in fact can say, and if what the informer can say is not going to be in any way crucial, important, helpful to the defense theory, which is the reason the defense is asking for it, then that informer's identity should not be disclosed.
Why don't we try and apply that here? Now, is the test as to whether the trial judge's decision would have been different? Is that what we're applying the test to? Because there was an expert in communication, or is the test applying to the ultimate here ultimately at the trial?
I think it's a little of both. I think you look at what the trial court did, and the reviewing court is supposed to look at that in terms of exercise of discretion. Here we've got a partial, if you will, improper exercise by considering the unsworn memo. But I think then when an error has occurred, the reviewing court is in the position of looking at the entire record and saying, was that an error that's going to have affected by a reasonable probability?
All right, so what is the defendant's, you said the defendant made the threshold showing so that you thought the information from the informant would be relevant or helpful to the defense.
Potentially.
Sure. What's the defense here, mistaken identity?
Yes.
Okay. So we've passed the threshold. Now that the defendant has passed the threshold, the burden is on the state, right?
Right.
You must show that there's no way you can restate that this information would create a reasonable doubt, right?
Correct.
All right. How do you show that?
Well, I think in this case, it's a little peculiar in the sense that the trial court here, the state presents the information that would, in fact, show that the informer cannot give testimony in a way that would benefit the defendant. The trial court then, in some sense, acts in the stead of defense counsel to say, wait a minute, I have to look at this closely. Is this or is this not going to be helpful to the defendant? In this case, for example, Although the trial court didn't do this, and although this isn't elaborated in the briefs, when it's an identity issue, the trial court could, for example, look at the five-factor tests for reliability of an out-of-court identification and apply those and say, yeah, the informer says, you know, we've got this information that the informer would identify the defendant as the perpetrator. And the court could, the defense could submit questions. I mean, there's different ways this could be done. The defense could say, please ask the informer this and this and this to ensure that, in fact, whether or not he or she could give helpful testimony. In the case of an identity, an out-of-court identification, the trial court could look at the same factors, opportunity to view the suspect, the defendant, the degree of attention that was at the time by the informer.
And you get
all those factors.
Okay, you get all that, and this guy was misidentified, right? They first identified somebody else, thank you. Right?
Early on, there was a
early on, floor. What do you mean early on?
Early on. There were 8 drug buys, and some point, I think, right before the 3rd drug buy, a photo was pulled by a computer, and one of the 2 undercover officers said, and it gave a name, and then a photo was relating to that name, and the officer said, that looks like the guy. The officer then went out on the drug buy that night, and afterwards had some doubts about it. Anyway, the name of that third-party photo identification was used in these reports right up until the very last report. Both agents used it, even though there were different informers involved here. And the second undercover officer never identified the photo of the third party. In fact, later on, specifically said it wasn't.
Did the informants ever look at the photos and identify?
The third party? I don't think of the third party, only of Van Manavong, as I understand it.
The officers who made the buy misidentified the defendant.
One of them, on one occasion, right.
After 2 buys, right.
He had done one, and it was going on in his second. The other officer had already done one buy, but nobody knew the name at that point, or put a name to it. Then they realized after further investigation, apparently because this officer who had done the third party ID was in Dallas after the second drug buy, they discovered that this third party that had been identified was actually in jail out of state, so it obviously couldn't have been him. So they took further efforts to try to make sure who it was that was doing this, and that included surveillance. There was surveillance at a traffic stop at which this person was present. There was surveillance at the residence. They knew where these calls were going, the residence. They staked out the residence. They watched this particular defendant come and go. And at that point, they had information that, in their minds, made it clear that this was, in fact, the guy.
How'd they find out his name?
I'm sorry?
How did they find out his name?
I believe at the time of the traffic stop, he gave a name, and it might have been Sing Chen, I think was the name, which is the name he was tried under. Bless you again. Sing means short, apparently, and the nickname for this guy was Shorty, so there's that added degree of confidence in the identification made by the undercover officers. And I think there was another name that the defendant offered at some point, and I can't remember exactly, like Nay Sang. And again, the first part of the name means short. And somehow, eventually, they came to the name Van Manavong. But it was through the defendant who identified himself. Beyond that, I can't say.
That's where they had to guess that it was this other guy. Just didn't know his name, is that it?
Right.
Defendant, okay.
In applying, just to get back to what the in-camera court is doing, that it's not really weighing between the state and the defense. What it's doing is it's looking at what the informer's testimony would be and saying, you know, if the informer can't identify the if the informer would identify the defendant, and there's no reason to dispute that, like I said, the five-factor test could be applied. And here, certainly on post-conviction review, if you applied that test, you got multiple drug buys, you got, they're in the car with the guy, they knew him by the nickname, they had actually I believe the trial testimony of the undercover officers indicated that these, must have been the affidavit, that the informers had personally bought from the guy before. They knew where he lived, knew the phone number. They just didn't know his name. I see my time is up. Thank you.
New counsel. Mr. Brown, representing the defendant.
May it please the court, my name is John Brown, and I do represent the defendant, Mr. Van Manavong, in this case. I understand the law development function of this court, but the key issue that I believe is before the court for its determination is the standard to be applied to determine after an in-camera inspection of evidence whether to disclose an informer's identity. I'd just like to point out initially that that has never really been our issue in this case. My client's issue in the Court of Appeals was that the trial court failed to follow proper procedures when it conducted the in-camera review. There was never a claim by us that the standard that was applied at that time was in error in any way.
What standard was applied?
It doesn't really refer much to a standard. I don't know
what the judge did. Standard the judge applied.
I don't know what standard the judge applied specifically. He had some, like a two-sentence finding, but to be honest, I can't recall. But we were not objecting at all to the standard that was applied at that review. Our objection was that the process was not done correctly. And I guess the court had asked previously about whether the ex parte communication would have been a violation. That is not something we were discussing much directly previously. My thought is, and I went and looked at the statute just on that point, would be that the statute does contemplate the state producing the evidence and then the judge examining it without parties present, but doesn't really contemplate the judge going out and gathering evidence. So I would say that the statute really does not contemplate what I think Your Honor called it ex parties communications by the court. I think that the burden is placed on the state or a subdivision of the state, and I would interpret that to mean the district attorney's office or the appropriate state agency, not the judge. But I don't have any law on that. That's just from my reading of the statute, as we said here. I do also agree that if that had been done, perhaps some of the problems we have here would have been avoided. A key point for us is that the trial court, in our opinion, has not yet applied the standard correctly, whatever the standard is. We can't do a harmless error analysis yet because we don't know what the evidence is, really, that the court is going to consider. It's been remanded by the Court of Appeals for the court not to make a finding, not to disclose anyone's identification, but to conduct the hearing correctly and see what these informants have to say on the issue of identity. The Court of Appeals has just instructed the court to bring them in, listen to what they say, and then decide. Where we got into trouble, I think, that we, why we're here, is because when the Court of Appeals gave that decision, made that determination of what should happen, it also basically instructed, put some language in instructing the trial court as to what the standard should be when the trial court conducts them. But we're not there yet, and the petition for review that was filed just asked the court to examine the standard on remand. Really didn't get into all the harmless error analysis or ask the court to take that issue up. Our position is...
Do you agree that the standard that the Court of Appeals suggests is an incorrect standard based on the concurring opinion in Outlaw and the Dowell case?
Well, since we're here on the standard, I figure I'd give the court what I think the standard should be. I understand the language that the state doesn't like. My opinion of what the standard should be, you have to look at a couple things. I think you have to look at the statute first. I think you do have to look at Roviaro. I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly. And you look at those in light of, I think, State v. Dow, which clarified some things. And our standard, and this is modified a tad from what I put in my brief, so let me just say this. Our proposal would be that looking at the statute, it's not whether an informant can provide evidence. The statute says if it is reasonably probable. Those words are in the statute. So if it is reasonably probable that an informer has evidence that is necessary for a fair determination of guilt or innocence, the informant's identity should be disclosed. Now that brings us to the next question, is when is it necessary? And I think that's what the state was analogizing to State v. Green, where the court gave a definition of necessity in that case. My definition of necessity then, though, would be for this court, from Roviaro and Dow, in essence. And it would mean the evidence would be necessary, the testimony would be necessary, if it's relevant and supports a defense. Then the testimony would be necessary. I think that's a standard you can get from kind of the meshing of the opinions in Outlaw. I disagree with the beyond a reasonable doubt language from Outlaw. I think the state standard as proposed today was a little different than what it proposed in its brief. I have down as the proposal in the brief that a confidential informant's identity should be disclosed only when the informant can supply testimony. I indicated I don't agree with the word can. That would strongly support the proffered defense theory and thus create a reasonable doubt of the defendant's guilt. That's in the brief today. I think I heard them say could create a reasonable doubt. I think there's a difference there. I still would disagree with that standard. I don't like the reasonable doubt language, but I think what they proposed today is a little different from what's in the brief. The reasons why I think our standard, I guess the standard I'm proposing is the correct one. First of all, I think the state standard is too strict. I think it's outcome determinative, and this is a little odd. We're after the trial, but this hearing is conducted early on before trial. Might be early on, I suppose it might be close to trial, but somewhere pre-trial. And a beyond a reasonable doubt standard, I think, is very hard to apply at that point. I do disagree with something that the state has said, and this is something I think it comes straight from the Outlaw concurrence. And I don't think the state standard recognizes any constitutional limitations of any sort on the standard. I think the Outlaw concurrence just did an exercise in statutory construction if I recall, looking up the word necessity in the dictionary and deciding how that fit in, and then determining that the beyond a reasonable doubt language would be appropriate because of the definition of necessity. I think that Roviaro makes clear that there are constitutional implications in the standard when interpreting the statute. We're not claiming at all that the statute is unconstitutional or anything like that, but that there are constitutional implications. I think Roviaro, that decision was founded on the idea of fundamental fairness. That language was used when it stated what it thought the standard was, and it was based on a balancing of the importance of the privilege versus a defendant's right to present a defense. So I think that the outlaw concurrence is incorrect when it says basically that there is no constitutional issue here. I think there are definitely constitutional implications in anything like this involving a defendant's right to present a defense. I think that the idea that there's a constitutional issue here was recognized by the Court of Appeal in Shifra, which was discussed a little bit in the briefs. And in Shifra is one of those counseling records cases where there's a statute that gives you an absolute bar, basically, to disclosing counseling records. But the Shifra court adopted, basically, the Roviaro analysis as far as an in-camera, whether or not there was the burden was met to provide an in-camera review. And it referred to the constitutional issues involved and felt that Roviaro protected the due process rights of the defendants in that sense. This court in Green did review Shifra, and I think in Green this court made it very clear that these are constitutional issues. I believe that this court in Green identified the standard of review in that case as being based on constitutional issue of due process and found that there would be a de novo standard of review, so to speak, as far as a court of appeals determining whether a standard was met. So I think when you look at Green, look at Shifra, all relying on Roviaro, all of those cases that go back to Roviaro are saying there's constitutional issues, but the outlaw concurrence is saying, in this case, there aren't. It would be, I think, anomalous to have the records cases based on some constitutional principles and the informants cases not, especially in light of the Green Court's statement that they were going to raise the standard a little bit in that circumstance in Green above the standard that was in Shifra for production for the test for the in-camera inspection because of the importance of that privilege of the counseling records. That is in the Green case, that the standard in that case is a little higher than the standard in informant cases. So that kind of brings me back around to what should the standard be in informant cases, and I think it should be a little less from the Green language than what you have in Green as far as the test for necessity. And I think the state commented on the test for necessity and what the Green court's position was on that and what the Green court's definition was. It did use some language. I think it defined necessity, and I have it here. It was defined in terms of evidence that might tend to, I'll say assist, I just can't find it right, tend to assist the defendant in his, might tend to counter the idea that he's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. I should have that here and be able to tell that to you a little better. But it still had the beyond a reasonable doubt language in it.
I don't think that's applicable here. Green, not applicable.
I think it sets the ceiling, though. I think it sets the ceiling for what the standard should be, because it does say that there's a more important privilege at work in those cases than in this case. And so I think it's going to be a little less than that, and I think that's what our standard is. I think our standard is a little less than what the Green standard might be, and it adequately preserves the privilege.
Here's what the trial court said. Trial court said, and it's in the Court of Appeals opinion, trial court said, I do not believe that the disclosure of the identity of the informants in this case would be necessary, doesn't define necessary, but says would be necessary for a fair or complete determination of the issues. Then it goes on to say, interests of justice doesn't require it, but what about the standard that if you say necessary, it doesn't mean absolutely needed, but is reasonable, which is the usual definition in the law about necessary. Anyway, for a fair and or complete determination of the issues, is that a standard you'll go along with?
I think that is the broad standard, necessary to a fair determination of the issues. I don't think that automatically translate into a burden of proof issue. I think that...
What's one thing in harmless error to say and say test the evidence, but here we don't have a trial yet, so we can't very well use right. The harmless error test.
That's our position.
Because that's your position. So if you said that I don't believe that the disclosure of the identity of the informants in this case is relevant or material to the defense for a fair or complete determination of the issues, would that be okay? I'm trying to put in the definition of necessary.
If the trial court said that?
Yeah.
We don't believe it's relevant or material?
Yeah. And you don't even need material because relevance includes materiality.
Right.
So
right.
It's relevant, it supports a defense. That's right. What you said.
Right.
Okay, relevant supports a defense and would assist in a fair or complete determination of the issues. Is that your...
I think that's fair. I think if it's relevant and supports a defense, you should disclose it because that's necessary. Then it is necessary for a fair determination of the issues. That's what I would say on that. And I would like to, again, backtrack from something in my brief. I think we get in a little confusing area here when we talk about pre-trial and post-trial and all of that. I think there should be one standard, and I think that's what the court did in Green. One definition of necessity, one test. And then in Green, the court pointed out that there would, of course, then be a harmless error analysis. And I think what I put in for my close conviction standard really is more appropriate to what the harmless error analysis should be. There should just be one definition of necessity, however. And then you can look at, I think I had it in Ritchie language materiality, in terms of undermine a confidence in the outcome. I think that's more appropriately a harmless error analysis, which would apply, but not yet in this case, because we don't have all the evidence to apply that to. We don't know from anything in this record what those informants are going to say if they're asked, is this the man who you were dealing with on those days?
Tell me what the error is here.
The error was that they did not consider, they did not follow, the judge did not follow the statute, as far as what evidence it was going to consider at the in-camera hearing. All that the judge ended up considering were basically the affidavit submitted by the state.
Which is that okay?
That's fine. But the judge said that it wasn't of any use to him.
Okay.
So that and then the memo. And the memo is not fine because that was unsworn. So you take out the memo, and you take out the affidavits that the judge said he had no use for because they didn't help him any, you're left with nothing. So there is no evidence.
Well, what's the matter with Unsworn? Okay, it's a little goof. It's not sworn, but, you know, you're not saying they lied.
Well, that's the defense. The defense is saying that at trial a lot of times. Yeah, I don't know how else to put it. Sure, that's the defense. Lied or mistaken, you know, that's what they're saying. I don't know any other way around it.
Even if it was a sworn memo, you wouldn't have a chance to cross-examine.
Right. That's one reason why I think what the Court of Appeals did in this case, given the kind of case it is, I'm not saying this is appropriate in every case, but this is what they did. They ordered the testimony be taken from the informants, as opposed to taking more affidavits. The Court of Appeals pointed out the first step is to take affidavits. The court did that in this case. Affidavits didn't help. So the next step in the process is you go in and take the testimony from the informants.
And you're not going to be there?
No.
And will the state be there when they take testimony?
No.
The judge. We're not going to hear the informants. So they're going to decide whether anything they say is relevant and support the defense so that it would be for a fair and complete determination of the issues prior to this test.
That's correct. And I think what outlaws made clear, if anything, is that if those informants go in there and say, that's not the guy, everybody would agree, an outlaw, because that's similar to what happened there, that is relevant to whatever the standard is, that would have to be disclosed to the defense. Because...
Well, suppose they're shaky. Well, I thought originally it was somebody else, but...
I think it should be disclosed. I think an outlaw, what happened is the informant couldn't say... Yeah, I was looking for the word, thank you. Couldn't say precisely whether the defendant was there. Really couldn't remember. Couldn't identify him as being there. I don't think the informant and outlaw said he wasn't there. So, but definitely, we don't know what these informants are going to say. So if they say he's definitely not there, I think whatever test the court fashions, the test is met. That's why in some respects we look at it as like we don't really have a horse in this race. This wasn't the issue we were litigating down below, but I understand why it was taken. But our position is we're a little ahead of the game. If the Court of Appeals hadn't gone in and explained all this and said what to do at the trial court level on remand, I don't think we'd be here today. And that brings me to another question, this idea of what's helpful or helpful in fact. There's been some criticism or some question about language in these opinions. Well, you just don't determine whether it's helpful when you do or don't, because there was language in the Court of Appeals decision saying it's not for the trial court to determine whether it's helpful. I think that gets back to the outlaw case, where you take these things out of context. You use helpful in one context to mean one thing, and helpful in another context maybe to mean something else. In that case, it was clear, I think, to the outlaw lead opinion that, and just assume that this evidence was helpful to the defense in that sense. But the trial court, if I recall in that case, decided even though this informant couldn't identify this person, it showed that a transaction took place, and in the whole scheme of things, it wouldn't be helpful to the defense because it would help convict them. And I think that's where you get into this language about was it helpful versus helpful in fact, I think is how outlaw put it. That it's not really for the trial court to decide if it's helpful in fact. Because once you find that it's relevant and tends to exonerate, if I put it that way, once you find those things, I think it's helpful to the defense and should be disclosed. Now, whether it's helpful enough to win, we're getting into the question of what the state wants you to find then. It's got to be helpful enough to win the case. I don't think that should be the test. I think that's too high.
you think that the concurring opinion in Outlaw violates Roviero?
Yes. Yeah. I think it did just a pure statutory construction, not acknowledging any constitutional principle, saying we're going to construe our statute the way we think it's written, and that we think it requires, because of the word necessity, when necessary, it requires this high burden of proof, which I think is too high under Roviero.
Now, is the name of the informants, are the names of the informants known now, or are they still not known?
There were names in the materials.
That's what I thought.
Obviously, read the statute, you're not supposed to disclose it, no one haven't disclosed
it. So what's the whole point of sending it back for a secret in-camera proceeding?
I think the state addressed that, and something they found, I thought it made sense, how they addressed it. There's still good reason to just have the judge do this. We got to know what they're going to say. I don't think we want to have the defense out there interviewing them now. I don't think that's what the statute contemplates. I think if there's going to be an interview to see what they're going to say, that should be done by the judge.
But you don't object to that?
No.
Okay.
No. I think that's reasonable. And I think that's really about all I had to say.
So. Are there any further questions? Hearing none, we will thank you for your appearance, and we'll have Mr. Freiberg.
I have a question right away.
Sure.
Is it correct, as Mr. Grau indicated, that the competent evidence in the record doesn't really tell us what these informants are going to say, so we can't make a determination, assuming we fix up the law in the way that you are asking us to, that we can't really apply the test because we don't know what these informants are going to say, or at least there is no competent evidence in the record. There's the unsworn memo, but taking that out.
No, the affidavits, which is the question and answer of the photo show-ups, those were sworn affidavits.
But is that enough?
Informers. I think that's enough by itself for the trial court to have at least said that the informers were not going to be able to say that, for the trial court to conclude that the informers, if they testified, would say, this is the guy, we can identify him, this is the guy.
The trial court erred when he said it wasn't enough.
I don't think that's entirely also. I think what the trial court was concerned about was the misidentification of the, by one of the agents earlier in the process, and wanted to understand whether the informers had anything that would bear on that misidentification. So,
doesn't that amount to having to overrule the factual finding of the trial judge that this was of no use to him, which apparently is in the record?
I know what you're saying. I guess, you know, and I probably mixed together sort of the post-conviction review here and everything else that happened, as well as what happened just with respect to the pretrial in-camera process. And the reason I guess I suggest that probably it was, it might have been doubtful with respect to that particular point, but whether or not the misidentification aspect of it, whether the informers could enlighten the court on that, would have affected its application of the statute in terms of the reasonable doubt standard to require disclosure. I think that's a tough call, it's conceivable that maybe that wasn't enough at that point, but the fact that the memo was given to the defense, so the defense knew exactly what the trial court knew about it and was able to test it through cross-examination at trial, should be enough to cure that problem. But
I assume the issue of the misidentification by the cop was fully explored at trial.
Correct.
And so what we're talking about is corroborating evidence on the misidentification theory.
You know, yes, whether the informers could say anything, why that could have happened, how that could have happened.
Or that they likewise misidentified.
Right. Right. And I think in this case, the affidavits that say, you know, this is the guy, we can identify him as the guy, went pretty far in establishing that they couldn't give helpful testimony. The unsworn memo is a problem. I'll concede that, and that certainly we concede that was error, but we think it's harmless error.
What test do you use for harmless
error? For harmless error, the traditional harmless error standard, that this could not have... I'm sorry.
Which tradition?
Are you caught up?
I'm saying that beyond that, but for the error, but for the fact that it was. Okay, I'm sorry. There's.
It's an inside story. You know, State versus Harvey.
Yes. Okay. I was afraid this might be asked, and I'll supplemental brief it if you want me to. The difference between the Harvey language and the Dias language, is that what you're...
Yeah.
Yeah, the rational...
So which
juror.
One are you doing?
I'm saying that I would have to think about it more to say which one applies, but that either one is met here.
Right.
That's what I'm saying, that either one is met here.
But you're going to look at the trial evidence, right? To do... At what stage are you going to apply?
At the post... This is at the period
of
post-conviction.
The whole thing.
Post-conviction review. All
right.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Don't think that State versus Harvey now sets forth the test in Wisconsin?
Well, it certainly does for the situation of an erroneous jury or a failure to give a jury instruction on an element. I hesitate to say too much about it because this is an issue that we've been debating, frankly, in our office as to whether it makes the standard more favorable or less favorable. A higher standard or a better standard or not. And quite honestly, my opinion is I think they're the same. I think they're really not intended to be different. But if they are, they're better for the state is what I would suggest.
The other is better for the state.
Further you say it does.
We get the picture. I get the picture.
Mr. Freeman, why do you think that you have to have two standards, one for pre-trial or during trial and another one for post-trial?
I wrestled with this, and I think the language is very, very similar. And at one point I was, in fact, when I was doing the brief, I probably suggested as much that they were very similar, that the standard for pretrial disclosure is it's got to be at this high level to reasonable doubt, because otherwise you're emasculating the informer's privilege and the reasons for it. If it's purely support, there could be a lot of evidence that purely supports the defense, but unless it goes right to the crux of the defense theory. And for post-conviction review, when you're looking at it, you're looking at not just what happened in camera, but you've got the additional trial record. So even though that standard is articulated very similarly in terms of that it would have had to make a difference in the outcome of trial, I think the standards are really quite similar, but for the added fact that you've got a trial record to play it against.
So you wouldn't be overly concerned if the same standard was applied pre-trial and post-trial, if I read you.
That's correct. That's correct. And the standard that I articulated at the beginning is really the harmless error language, I think, the reasonable probability but for disclosure. And maybe that standard doesn't capture really what the post-conviction review of the non-disclosure itself is. It's sort of a two-part. One, and this was Justice Abrahamson's question early on, I think, is the first part is you're looking at whether this should have been disclosed or not. And that standard should probably be the same, I think, reasonable. You're looking at whether it would make a reasonable doubt. But then, even if you say that there was an error and the standard was met and should have been disclosed, then you apply harmless error. Does that make sense? I hope. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you, Mr. Freiman. Thank you, Mr. Grell, for your arguments in 003257 CR and State v. Van Landen.